Hello, welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising podcast. I'm your host, Andy Cleff, and I'm delighted to be joined today by Jessica Katz, who's a trainer, mentor, and coach at Liberated Elephant. Jess, we were comparing notes, and the dog is barking at a delivery person. We crossed paths 5 years ago at one of Lisa Atkin's boot camps.
Yep, I think so.
Two Michaels were there, and Lisa was up in Boston at that great retreat center.
Yes, that was a great retreat center.
Does that feel like forever ago to you too? 5 years feels like decades right now.
Certainly when you count 2020 in, 2020 alone feels like decades.
Good point. We were both just starting, you know, on this coaching facilitator path back there. And in the 5 years since, we both have been in different places. And you started your consulting firm called Liberated Elephant?
That's right.
How long has that been running?
I'm in my fourth year.
Wow.
In my fourth year, yeah.
Tell me a little bit of the story of the name.
Sure. So I also went through Lisa's 10-month coaching cohort program. And one of the things that you do when you go through that coaching cohort program is identify your coaching stance. And one of the things in my coaching stance is helping elephants in the room, essentially. And, you know, I'm trying to help folks get the elephant in the room out and make it usable instead of something we hide and disguise.
Oh, that's powerful. I, in a couple of situations when we were back in the same room all the time, had a small, like 2-inch plastic elephant, which I would have either in a pocket or nearby or somewhere. And when things got really awkward, just quietly put it on the table. People were like, what's that? I'm like, you tell me. And it would open up that conversation. And sometimes it would be a team member finally being able to say something that they've been holding back, addressing, quote, management or leadership. Or sometimes it would just be leadership, you know, exposing a disconnect about communication, right? And so is that what you're seeing?
Yeah, a lot of communication breakdowns. A lot of, you see the most where safety is at risk, right?
Yeah.
Where somebody is afraid to speak truth to power or afraid to take a risk or a chance on something that might be, they might be able to experiment with, but they're afraid to do it because of the environment.
Has that changed in 2020?
No, it hasn't changed in 2020.
Has all of us suddenly being remote, whether we wanted to or not, made that any different through your lens and the people you're supporting?
Well, you know, one thing I see that is changing is that the leaders, managers and leaders are recognizing that they have to serve their employees differently. And that's, you know, some of what we've talked, you know, we've been talking about for years as agilists is, you know, the manager has to come in from a personality, relationship-centered approach to leadership, helping folks grow instead of trying to tell them what to do. And now they don't have access to their employees all the time. They have maybe Slack, they might have Teams or some other, you know, tool to network, and they've got to figure out, how do I connect with these employees? And they're focusing now on connection over, you know, tasks. And that's been a really beautiful, beautiful bit of exposure I've seen in the 2020 world.
Yeah, I can see how that's possible, but I can see how it's also difficult because you're not in the same place. So much of those interactions now have to be scheduled one-on-ones, or you use some sort of a virtual collaboration tool. We're starting to explore a little bit with Sococo just to see where everybody is, because we're no longer in the same facility, and the serendipitous opportunity of observing something becomes more difficult.
Yeah.
But you're right, we're still people. And we're still in need of leadership. There's, as we were preparing for this show, we picked a couple of topics, and I'll just outline them out here, and then we'll sort of dance in and out. Making leadership a competitive advantage, really important, and the way things are going right now, balancing the conflicting roles that one faces in complex systems. And then I understand you also have a book coming up that covers some of these topics for middle managers.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's plenty of advice for people in various locations. It'd be great to see what you're coming up with for middle managers. Let's talk a little bit about leadership as a competitive advantage. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, you know, you see those memes and LinkedIn posts and Twitter posts out there about people don't leave companies, they leave bad bosses, you know? And that's essentially what I'm saying is you can also get people to stay for good bosses. And if we make leadership a competitive advantage, then we attract people to our organizations instead of running people off. And you can see it inside large organizations. Often there'll be like a reputation a really good leader has where people want to go work for that leader instead of for the leader they're with. You can see just in large organizations, not to mention the greater population of job employment, right?
Yeah. What are some of those things that you're seeing that creates that attractive nature of a good leader?
So some things that I see are those that are really good at tying the work a person does to the purpose the company has. Mm. So really being able to tie it, and even better if they can extrapolate it out to the individual's personal passions, right? This, you know, our company is about in healthcare, our company is about patient health, right? And this person down in the echelons of IT or in the, you know, minutiae of back-end corporate land, accounting, IT, HR, how are they helping make a patient's life better? And being able to tie what they're doing to that and really hit on what's exciting for that person. But to do that, you have to really know that person's passions. So there's this relationship building that's so important for leaders. You know, what's important to my employees? What's going on in their family? What struggles do they have that make it hard for them to work every day? Whether that's internal or external to the company. What ways do they want to grow? What do they want to be when they grow up? I feel like we do that several times in our lifetime, right? What do I want to be when we grow up? And supporting it instead of saying, oh, well, that's in conflict to what we do here, is such a big change in the way we think about our employees.
What are some ways that they can do that? And I'll give you some context. Mm-hmm. I was talking to somebody the other day, series of interviews, you know, how long you've been with the company and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, well, only 4 months. I'm like, so that means you started after March 13th. Yeah. How many people in the company have you met? Long silence, right? Yeah. Two out of 100. So how in this, you know, in the next year where new employees, whether they're, you know, internal transfers or incoming, how does a leader bring to light those personal passions of new team members or even team members that are now in this completely different situation? What are some ways that that can happen?
Well, so back in the day, they would do it through one-on-ones. Maybe they'd have conversations with folks. There'd be a welcome lunch, so you get to meet your team. And there would be, you know, maybe your manager, I know I worked with a manager once who did this, maybe your manager would give you a list of people you should meet and why you should meet them, right?
Yeah.
So I don't think those things are lost to us. You could still have a team lunch on video where everybody gets together on video and it's slightly more facilitated so that you can get the conversation flowing and people bring their lunch and have a welcome to the team lunch. You could still have a list of people that they're responsible for getting in touch with and setting up time with, right? And the reason why. And you definitely still want to have one-on-ones, but I think the frequency has to go up. You're not in each other's faces all day, so you probably have to meet with folks more often than you used to.
There's another big piece of it. I know both you and I are fans of Brené Brown and this idea of courage and vulnerability being together, not opposites. What do leaders do to demonstrate both of those?
Well, I think one thing they do is they talk about what they've messed up on really out loud. Some examples in my own history, you know, if I make a misstep, even a little misstep, hey, I was unkind to this person, or hey, I said this and it landed wrong for them. We've since talked about it and now it's okay. But here's what I said and the way it didn't work, right? And just those little modelings of here's where I messed up and here's how I fixed it and here's where we are now, can be such a big indicator for other people in the organization that it's safe to make mistakes. And you're more likely to have, if a leader's willing to do that, you're more likely to believe the leader will have your back if you make a mistake.
Nice. So oftentimes in software industry, individual contributors that are highly effective on a team get promoted, right? You're great at X, congratulations, you're now the leader of all the people that do X. What are some good learning resources you've found for these, for this middle management cohort, which is the topic of your new book?
Yeah. So for middle managers, the first thing is to recognize you're not a doer anymore, right? Maybe you do some, but the bulk of your work is not doing anymore. Now it's lifting others, right? Even if you move into a tech lead role, there's an education and a teaching that has to happen for your folks. And the majority of your work will be about networking, connecting, removing blockers so other folks can do the work, not so you personally can do the work of delivery, right? But, you know, in the resources, I recommend, anything by Brené Brown. She's pretty amazing, right? I'm gonna turn and look at my bookshelf a minute. The Culture Code is a really good book. I think that's a really good book for starting to get sort of the sense of how to see your company culture beyond just the minutia of the tactical. And raising it can help you like raise your sense of the network that's going on around you. And you know, I don't think there's just one book for this, but being able to really paint the vision in a strategic way and get out of the way so other people can do tactical is one of the big learnings when you're in the role of advocacy. But a manager, you know, they advocate for their employees, they help them grow and learn, and they get blockers out of the way and they paint vision. They're also enforcers inside the organization, and they're enforcing policies and procedures that might actually be counterproductive to the things the company wants. And learning how to balance the role of advocate and enforcer, which is the meat of my book, right? So we're balancing three roles as a manager: advocate, enforcer, and employee. You are an employee who wants probably to promote and have forward motion. You are an advocate for your employees, and you're an enforcer of the company policies and procedures. And yeah.
Interesting.
And you're actually, when you become a manager, you're taking on all three of those roles.
Yeah, I clearly see two out of the three. I'm struggling a little bit with enforcer. Let me start on the easy ones. Yeah, you're an employee. So you have a responsibility to grow and learn and be a teammate to help your peers grow, to be a mirror above and below, right? Those blind spots. And when you're now a leader in any position, to advocate the people that you're serving, enforcement is the one I'm struggling with. So obviously there's constraints. We have this, you know, even in any agile methodology, this concept that teams are fully autonomous is so misunderstood. It's not without accountability or constraints. Right. Otherwise we'd be on vacation.
Right. Right.
So is that where enforcement comes in?
It can be. So some of your enforcement can be around, these are the guardrails. You have autonomy within these guardrails, for example. Like maybe the company might set a 9 to 3 working hours. You have to be available between the hours of 9 to 3, which means you could be a 7 to 4 person or a 9 to 6 person. You've got some flexibility around that's your autonomy, right? They might give guardrails that says, we want you to work on this piece of the product within this direction only, in this thin slice of direction. I know there's other ideas out there, but put them down and we'll look at them later, right? That might be another guardrail space that people go into. But they're also enforcing the company culture and the policies and procedures that exist at the company. So let's say somebody, here's a really good example. So you have a lot of implicit expectation in people's behavior, and it's usually driven by culture. So if you've got somebody who, you've got a Slack channel and somebody starts talking about their own political opinions, right? Which happens inside organizations.
Sure.
A manager might choose to shut that down because it's not appropriate for the office and it's outside what is an expected behavior inside the office setting. That can conflict with the values that are written on the wall. Even though the behavior is expected, the values on the wall could be bring your whole self to the office, even if it's politics, right? There could be this like, bring everything right. You've got. Okay, I'll bring everything I got, but that includes politics, right? And now what do I do with this conflict that's happened inside the organization? And so as an enforcer, you might believe in the value on the wall, but know that it actually has limits and you have to really enforce that limit.
If the team is unable to do it themselves.
That's right. That's right.
I'm going to presume that the first choice is to give the team the space, but prevent damage or too much damage from occurring.
That's right. The unfortunate truth is often when you enforce, you create damage.
Yeah. So how do you balance that? Right. Because you're taking away the ability or you're setting expectations that, oh, you know, conflict, manager set leader has to deal with it now.
Yeah.
And suddenly that self-organization that needs to happen quickly, right, often in real time, is gone.
Yeah. This is where I think practices that we see in restorative justice can be really helpful.
Tell me more.
Restorative justice is a criminal justice practice wherein they say, okay, when you break the rules, that's true, you've broken the rules and you've have some consequence. Maybe it's jail time, maybe it's a fine, right? Those sorts of things. But if we apply restorative justice and we look at healing as the objective, and we say, when you broke the rules, you caused harm, and that harm needs to be healed, and you bring the person who was harmed and the person who harmed together and help them get to a path of healing, you can rebuild a space. I mean, obviously, we're not talking about crime here. We're talking about, you know, a social misstep, right? But you could heal the harm that's been done and perhaps recover trust or even make a stronger relationship out of that. And I don't think we're skilled in that particular approach to dealing with bad actors.
I agree with you 100%. It is more common that people just go silent and the elephant isn't on the table, right?
That's right.
Because there's no more table. It's all in Zoom. We need a few more reactions. Hashtag Zoom listening. Zoom US. Can I have an elephant instead of waving and thumbs up as well? So there's lots of learning. So you've talked at each level, growth, right? How, as an organization, do we allow for more slack time, more experimentation, more learning time? And what's the leader's role in making that possible?
Well, first of all, you have to check your environment. Is your environment actually open to that? let's say they're not open to it. I would say the first way to do that is to experiment with it. Take the leader could say, I'm going to set up a half day every sprint for my team to have some slack time, whatever that translates out to. Google does something like this too, and I can't think of what they call it, but essentially gives them a day to go slack and learn and grow and maybe dig into that code they didn't know anything about last sprint, or go learn a new library that's come out in some coding language, or go read a book that would better them as an individual. So they could say, let's run an experiment. And the thing, then you have to decide what you measure in the experiment, right? Before, when we were running at full board without any breathing room, we were this productive and we had this much error and it was this, you know, whatever the measurement is, they decide to choose for that. And then now let's run the experiment and do the cross measure and see, all right, well, what's true here? If we give some slack time, what happens? You know, it's counterintuitive, you know, we're 100% utilization is a fallacy. We can't actually function 100% of the time. In fact, a recent study said that when we were in the office, we only worked about 2.5 hours a day. So, you know, it's not like we're getting a lot done anyway, even when we're 100% utilized. Wouldn't it be great if we had that 15 minutes every morning to like breathe, consume my calendar, and it was a normal behavior? Leaders can model that behavior. And leaders who have done that have seen incredible increases in their productivity. So you know, I think it's a little bit of modeling, a little bit of experimenting if you've got an organization that isn't ripe for it, right? And And I think a little enforcement. Hey, dude, it's not okay to work 60 hours. Chill out. It's okay to take a breather.
There is a balance, but there's also a cycle time to that. So these experiments that you talk about, they don't provide immediate, well, maybe sometimes within a sprint, you might learn something new, but they're long-term. Mm-hmm. And so here we have organizations with constant pressure to produce, deliver, et cetera. Is that part of the advocate role or the enforcer role?
To create the space, I think, and as an advocate, you're creating the space for breathing room. I think as an enforcer, if you decide you're going to be in the enforcer role, then you choose to continue the pressure downstream. And that's where it rubs for the leader as an employee, right? If I advocate to help my team, then they're going to get the space they need that I know they need to regroup and think through their plans and all of that. But if I enforce what the company's telling me to do, I know it's going to hurt my team, but it's going to help my promotion.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Pretty perverse incentives.
Right. And so, so the manager has to make a decision, right? Do I want to enforce a way of being, do I want to advocate for a way of being that isn't in our culture, or do I want to enforce the culture that exists here? And they will undoubtedly hurt they have a high potential to hurt their promotion ability or their, what's the word I'm looking for? Or their raise, you know, the potential raises coming downstream when they step out of line with the whole company's culture.
So are you headed to performance feedback systems are broken?
Oh, absolutely. They're broken. Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't want to assume. Yeah. So maybe that's a whole nother book, but how do you fix that when there's these competing incentive programs, right? If you want to be, I don't want to say evolved, but an effective leader in complex environment, we're not talking about production line, right? We're not talking about Henry Ford's, you know, get it from 12 hours to 90 minutes to blah, 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 however many seconds companies are producing cars off the automotive line by optimizing defined process. This is empirical, right? Mm-hmm. And then what are the performance metrics that make sense for a leader to be judged against? You know, we've touched on optimization. That's nonsense, right?
Right.
Is it something like tenure? Do you have employee ENPS for leaders? Are there other things that make more sense as performance feedback for leaders that don't set up these perverse incentive systems?
Yeah, I think the employee ENPS rating is wonderful. I think, you know, the leader is also on a team of other leaders. So you probably have some 360 feedback coming in from your peers. And, you know, what's the behavior you want them to do? Do you want them to build relationships or do you want them to drive delivery? The people who are doing delivery are the best to drive delivery. So it makes more sense to help have the manager be more about relationships and potentially measuring them on large systemic problems. But that's a long tail. Right. When you're doing change management on long systemic problems, it's a long tail. Ultimately, if I had my way and I could design every company's HR system, money and promotion wouldn't be tied to performance evaluations at all. That you would just get paid enough and it would no longer be, you would no longer need to have that conversation. Everybody gets paid enough to live comfortably, regardless of their role. And we would title them when they felt they needed titling for their career path or whatever, right? And performance would be about growth and learning instead of about how much money am I going to make.
Have you seen this in any form, in any place yet?
Yes.
Awesome.
Gravity Payments run, I can't think of Dan Price, I think is the CEO's name. I should double check that. But Gravity Payments, they are a company out of the West Coast. This CEO said, was walking with one of his friends on a hike one day, I think I'm remembering the story correct, and his friend worked for him and was struggling to make ends meet. Meanwhile, he as the CEO has plenty of money, right? And he's like, why does it need to be this way? And he went to flat salaries. Everyone in the company got a flat salary, and this was years ago, of $70,000. And I think they're up to $130,000. Everybody gets $130,000 now. Okay. Doesn't matter what role you're in, it includes him. And he had to like sell property and do all kinds of things to make it possible in the first year. And he lost a few people. There's some people are still tied to the idea that I want to get paid for my work and I should always make, you know, I want to be able to progress through money, right? And that's how they evaluate themselves. So they lost some people. But what they did see was an increase in customer satisfaction because their employees were happier. And they also saw a baby boom. Everybody had babies because they could afford them. Right? So those are some, you know, side effects. When you take money off the table and you stop making my relationship to the company transactional and you start making my relationship to the company relational, my mood about the company changes, right? Now it's, yes, that's true. They're paying me to be here and I can leave or stay or whatever. But at the end of the day, I feel valued as an individual and I know that I'm valued as an individual because they want me to be happy, healthy, and whole in all aspects of my life.
So employee engagement leads to higher customer satisfaction scores. I've suspected as much.
Yeah.
And here we have it, N=1 data point. Anywhere else coming close?
I don't know of anyone else doing that sort of thing. You might have somebody, you know, an interesting thing to add to Gravity Payments. When coronavirus hit, they saw a decrease in revenue. And rather than cut people's salaries, they reached out to everybody in the company and said, what do you think we should do? And the decision by the company was, I'm going to tell you how much I can afford not to make, and we'll temporarily cut our own pay based on that information. So if somebody could afford to take less, they would.
Powerful.
Right. And the whole group came together. And you've heard some stories about that too, where there's a big hairy problem and the leadership comes to the folks that work there and say, here's our big hairy problem. We saw it in manufacturing where there was a company that didn't have enough manufacturing or didn't have enough runway. And so they were going to dock everybody's pay. And they said, but let's talk to you about it. And instead, what they decided to do was unpaid vacations. And the people that couldn't afford to have unpaid vacations, other people that could afford it would take a longer vacation, essentially.
Yeah. I've heard of that story quite a bit.
Yeah.
Maybe it's the same organization that keeps resurfacing.
It could be. That could be. And there's some other, you know, just sort of, here's an example where leadership decided to drive a company culture. And this would be a good example. If you wanted to drive a culture, this is a good example of how to do it. And you'll notice in all of these, it's coming from leadership. So another one is Bridgewater. They're up in the Northeast. They're a hedge fund company. And they wanted to get rid of gossip. They didn't want any gossip. And so they record every single conversation that happens inside their four walls. When they first did that, the legal department freaked out. They're like, we can't do this. It'll open us up to too much stuff, right? And the result was actually it protected them. So when they got sued, they had all this recording data, right? The result, because everything was recorded, people's voices were getting heard at every level. They had ultimate transparency that during the 2008-2009 recession, they made money for their customers where everybody else was losing money for their customers. As a hedge fund manager, right?
Yeah. Another good story. And I'm curious if that is an aberration or has huge potential. Oh God, that's got to be pretty scary.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
No walls, no privacy.
They have a series orientation process as a result of it. If you look at their website, there's a series orientation process for it.
What else?
What else? In the realm of leadership in general or performance feedback? We wandered a little. Where do you want me to be?
we did. We're going full off script improv. Toss the ball up, right? Team member development, we've covered. Performance feedback, we've covered. Middle management growth. Incentive programs, right? So let's take this example. The company's gone to flat salaries. Is there profit sharing? Is the money invested back into the company if there's a great boon? What happens in that case? Because obviously it's work and we get paid. Mm-hmm. And there's a, as you pointed out, you know, there's a reasonable amount. Some people want more. Some people can get by on less. But how do we distribute the spoils of success, assuming there are some in 2020?
You know, I think we see the death of C-suite and high level major bonuses only going to those folks I think it's in its death throes. You know, I'm not, it's not to say those folks don't deserve a bonus. They were working too. It's, their work is valuable. It's just different. And my instinct is to say everybody gets an equal share, right? Just if they want it, right? So let's say we had a major bang up year, rather than it being the board members get millions of dollars, if they disseminated that out to all the people that actually made it possible, what an amazing world that would be. And maybe that means it's small when it gets down to everybody, but I think it would shift, you know, right now, publicly traded companies, you know, the benefit for gravity payments is they're private. Publicly traded companies have short-term goal-itis, right? They're short-term
only. Quarterly.
Quarterly, right?
Right.
And really, resilience comes from some long-term goals and planning. So if you want to build in resilience that can deal with things like coronavirus or those sorts of things, maybe you put it into a slush fund, your extra money. You put it into a slush fund that's your, that becomes your safe, your financial safety net. Or maybe you distribute it to everyone and you recognize, oh, these are the folks actually doing the delivery of the thing that made us money. Boy, they should really get some of these spoils.
Let me play devil's advocate a little bit.
Yeah, do it.
There will be different. So there's two thoughts that come to mind, individual versus team contribution. So that's one big bucket. And then figuring out level of impact, level of contribution, whether it's individual or team, right? How do you correlate? And you can't always do causation, but you know, that's a tough one if you're going to level it out and distribute it evenly.
My question is
fairly.
Right. My question is, why do we care? So if I'm the person sitting at my keyboard doing coding, and you're the person sitting in a boardroom handling board questions, is either of our work less valuable, or is it all just as valuable, just different? In which case, let's do it equally instead of fairly. Yeah.
History has said it's not equal. And I don't know if that's a failing of the capitalist system.
Yeah.
There's certainly a greater divide between the upper and lower echelons of pay. And that's been exposed dramatically in recent times.
Yeah. I mean, you have a company of 10,000 people. If all 10,000 people went on strike tomorrow, your company is going to a halt. You can't do anything. If you're in the C-suite, you can't deliver anything without those people. So to say that they're less valuable than the person in the C-suite, I think is a misnomer of our culture, or misrepresentation in our culture. And, you know, we're all valuable. And that's ultimately, I think, my personal passion is to move people towards more humanistic ways of thinking about work and humans, so that it's a much more level playing field. If you're in the C-suite, you and I both put our pants on the same way. Your pants have a higher thread count, maybe, and a nicer, right? A nicer material, because you make a ton more than me. But why do you make a ton more than me? If I wasn't here, could you still put pants on? Would you have pants left? Right? So it's that sort of thing. You know, we're all interdependent. It's a complex world, and our relationships are complex too.
Interesting thoughts. So we're coming up towards the end of the time box. Two questions, you know, what do you got coming up in the next month or so? And for people that want to get in touch with you, what are the best ways?
Sure. So got an Agile Indie meetup coming up on the 18th of August around creating boundaries, practicing curiosity, and making requests. And then on August 19th, I'm doing the Nashville product meetup, where I'll be discussing culture and retaining it in a distributed environment. So we'll dive deeper into some of those concepts. And then in September, I've got Tech Leaders of Nashville. I'm talking specifically to managers there and how to manage distributed employees. And then Agile Atlanta in November, where we'll be talking about the no estimates movement in Agile.
Uh-oh.
Right?
Serious lightning rod.
And then I also do some teaching through software education or SoftEd. And they are offering certified Agile coaching courses in August, October, and November that I'll be teaching. So,
and all this stuff's online, virtual?
Yep. You can find it on my website under my events calendar. You can see all those things with links to all the various things.
Yeah, we'll include a link to your website, liberatedelephant.com, in the speaker notes. And what's the best way to get in touch with you?
Best way is to come and connect with me on LinkedIn. You can reach out to me there or email me. Or if you really want to, you can go to that same website and book some time with me and do a quick 30-minute call and catch up.
Sweet. Well, thank you. It's been great to catch up with you. Let's not make it another 5 years, Jessica, right? Before we have an extended conversation. Thank you also to our audience. If you enjoyed this, give us a review, a rating, leave some comments. It helps other people find us. And if this is your first time tuning in, subscribe. You'll catch the next one. If you want to join the discussion and share your stories about putting the elephant on the table, come over to coalition.agileuprising.com or join the Discord server. Links for both of these are on agileuprising.com. And finally, support from listeners just like you help us feed the elephant, cover our hosting and production costs. See the show notes on how you can become a patron. Till next time, this is the Agile Uprising Podcast, signing out.
Spring, is that you? Warmer temps mean new Allbirds styles. Meet the Superlight Collection, the lightest ever shoes from Allbirds, now in fresh colors. These must-have travel shoes have a lighter-than-air feel and barely their fit that made them the most packable shoes ever. That means more comfort and less baggage. Try the Superlight Tree Runner with a cushy foam midsole and breathable eucalyptus fiber upper. Plus, they're comfy right out of the box. So, what can you do in a Superlight shoe? What can't you do is the better question. And because they're super packable, the real question is, where are you taking them? Experience how Allbirds redefines comfort. Visit Allbirds.com and use code SUPER24 for a free pair of socks with a purchase of $48 or more. That's Allbirds.com, code SUPER24.